all walks of life, from people of all walks of life. And Muhammad Yunus still enjoys that recognition. He also has, he's globally recognized, he has international legitimacy. So he is one of those people. I am not sure how much his economic vision actually plays a role in this or will play a role in this. Muhammad Yunus, as you know, in his earlier work had talked about social capitalism. His own position has changed. I'm not an economist, so I'm not going to dwell on that. But I think at this point, it's what he represents, having enjoying a kind of recognition beyond party politics, is what makes him an ideal candidate for the interim government.
And Professor Chaudhry, the significance of not only the student-led uprising, but now in Muhammad Yunus's government, they have included two students.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is unprecedented in the history of Bangladesh, although almost all of the successful political movements in independent Bangladesh have been led by students. And of course, then ordinary citizens joined them. So it's not surprising that the students led this protest, but their inclusion is unprecedented. But it also symbolizes the fact that you cannot ignore students as the youth, as young, as, you know, not really having the skills to understand what's going on politically, because I think it would be a grave mistake right now for anybody, including the military in Bangladesh, to disregard what the students were saying, because they were able to accomplish something that even the veteran political parties haven't been able to in the last 15 years. They had widespread support from ordinary citizens of Bangladesh. So I think it's great that the students are included. It's also strategic. I don't think you can actually have any kind of you know, policies right now without consulting with the students, who have shown so much maturity and efficiency in actually bringing this uprising about.
And being very clear, even as Sheikh Hasina fled to India and the military said they would, you know, caretake the government until there was an election, they said no to the military, even temporarily, Professor.
Yes, absolutely. There is very little faith. Again, the military is broadly seen as nonpartisan, despite its internal factions. But there is a history in this part of the world of military coups. So the students have been very clear from the very beginning that they don't want an interim government led by the military. And the military right now would make a big mistake if their own political ambitions come in the way. So, yes, they have been very clear about having a civilian-led government.
So, Shahid Al-Alam, in Dhaka, what's going to happen next? You've got this caretaker government headed by the man who pioneered microloans, not only in Bangladesh, but around the world, Muhammad Yunus. How long does this caretaker government go on? And will there be a role for someone like Khaleda Zia, who was freed just after the prime minister fled? She was the opposition candidate.
Well, Khaleda has been freed. But one of the things that the students also talked about was that they did not want dynasty politics. Khaleda Zia is the widow of General Zia, who was a former president. Sheikh Hasina is the daughter of Sheikh Mujib, who was the founding president. But these families have gone on, and the parties themselves have not been democratic. I think there is a great cry for some other option right now. What we have to see first is how this caretaker government manages this situation. This is uncharted waters. Neither Professor Yunus nor any of the other people in his cabinet have dealt with a situation like this. But then this cabinet has students. This cabinet has more women than in any previous cabinet. It has human rights activists. It has indigenous people. So minorities are also represented. But there are questions. There are questions in terms of the competence of some of the people. There are questions about whether some people are there because they've just been yes men from in the past and, you know, non-threatening. So those are questions that will exist. But to me, The hope is that the students have not stopped there. I was walking down the streets today. There has been violence in the streets because this anger has led to seeking revenge. And the students are managing the streets. The students have gone out in patrols at night to ensure that the robbery and the thuggery does not continue. And the students keep insisting that they want a government which really belongs to the people.
Finally, Shahad Al-Alam, on a slightly different issue, we've noticed in the streets as the tens of thousands of students and others protest that there have been flags of Bangladesh and flags of Palestine. You also have been an outspoken supporter of Palestinian rights. As we move into a segment in the United States and the role that Israel and Palestine will play in this election for the next president of the United States, if you can talk about what's happening here, there.
Well, I've just put on my kafir, which is what I usually wear. I hadn't remembered to do it then. But last night at the swearing-in ceremony, I was the only person from only non-student wearing a kafir. One of the students was also wearing a kafir, and the Palestinian ambassador came and hugged us both. But yes, at the time of the protests themselves, I remember a young man atop a tree waving both a Bangladeshi flag and a Palestinian flag. And this is something which is important for a different reason as well. While Bangladesh officially recognizes, talks about Palestine and its liberation, it has actually been trading with Israel. It's used Pegasus and other surveillance material. It's had training with Israel, and it has much more connections in terms of its military and its training than it likes to reveal. And the Bangladeshi constitution, in fact, says that it will be with all oppressed people across the globe. So it's a natural affinity, but the Bangladeshi people in particular do have a resonance with the Palestinian movement. And I think the students being there will ensure that once we've sorted out the internal things, we will be looking after Palestinian issues.
Well, Shahid Al-Alam, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Bangladeshi photojournalist and activist. He was detained by the Bangladeshi authorities back in 2018, and he was held for more than 100 days, leading a photojournalist in Bangladesh. And Nusrat Chaudhry, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of anthropology at Amherst College, author of Paradoxes of the Popular Crowd Politics in Bangladesh. Coming up, as Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris faces pressure to define her platform on Palestine, we'll speak with Leila Elabed, co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement, who spoke with Harris while she campaigned in Michigan on Wednesday. Stay with us. Again by Maqsood Odaka. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. This is War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. With more than 40,000 Palestinians dead and fears of an escalating regional war, Qatar, Egypt, and the U.S. issued a joint statement Thursday calling on Israel and Hamas to reach a ceasefire in Gaza. They called to, quote, resume urgent discussion on August 15th in Doha or Cairo to, quote, close all remaining gaps and commence implementation of the deal without further delay, unquote. This comes as Vice President Kamala Harris is facing pressure to define her platform on Palestine as the Democratic presidential nominee. On the campaign trail Wednesday, Harris and her vice presidential running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, spoke in Michigan, where more than 100,000 people cast uncommitted protest votes against Biden earlier this year in Michigan's primary election. At a rally in Detroit, Palestinian rights protesters disrupted Harris during her speech.
He intends to end the Affordable Care Act. You know what? If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that. Otherwise, I'm speaking.
Before the rally, Harris had a short exchange with two leaders of the Uncommitted National Movement who called for an arms embargo on Israel. Also Wednesday, Harris won the backing of the highest-ranking Arab-American official in Michigan's largest county, Wayne County. Assad Terfe told the Associated Press he, too, met with Harris and pressed for a ceasefire and that she, quote, gives us the best chance of achieving peace in that region moving forward, unquote. Meanwhile, Harris's national security advisor later wrote on X, quote, VP has been clear. She will always ensure Israel's able to defend itself against Iran and Iran-backed terrorist groups. She does not support an arms embargo on Israel. She will continue to work to protect civilians in Gaza and to uphold international humanitarian law, unquote. For more, we're joined in Southfield, Michigan, by one of the people who met with Vice President Harris. Leila Elabed is the co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement. Leila, welcome back to Democracy Now! You briefly spoke with the presidential candidate, Vice President Harris, on Wednesday before she addressed that crowd where she was interrupted by Palestinian solidarity protesters. Can you talk about where you were when you talked to her and what you said?
Yes. Thank you, Amy, for having me on. When Abbas Alawi and I had this moment to have a brief exchange with Vice President Harris and Governor Tim Walz, we were kind of backstage of the rally in a photo lineup. And it was just a very brief exchange. And I can go in a little bit more detail of, you know, what was said, what I said. In my exchange with her, I got very emotional. I told her, my name is Leila, I'm Palestinian. And in that moment, I was thinking about my community. I was thinking about the two community members I had just spoken to the day prior who told me they had lost over 100 members of their family each in Gaza. And I told Vice President Harris that I told her that. I said, right now, Michigan voters want to support you, but we need a policy change that is going to save lives in Gaza right now. My community members are losing tens to hundreds of their family members. Will you talk to me about an arms embargo? Will you talk to Uncommitted about an arms embargo? Will you meet with us? And she said, yes, she would meet with us. And so I did feel, you know, I was very emotional in that brief exchange. I did feel like her sympathy and empathy towards me was very genuine. But Palestinian children cannot eat words. We need more than sympathy or empathy. We need action. And we know that Kamala Harris's stance right now is not an arms embargo. We know that the policy of the White House is not an arms embargo, which is why we asked her if she would meet with us to talk about an arms embargo.
So what did she tell you in that brief meeting? And in that meeting, did you call for a further meeting? And what was your response to what she said to the protesters as they chanted?
In that brief, very brief exchange, I mean, it was only just a few minutes long. Like I said, I was very emotional, and I was, you know, facing directly towards Vice President Harris. And, you know, she was very comforting. She was very sympathetic and empathetic. And she nodded to everything that I was saying. You know, when I mentioned that our community members are losing tens of hundreds of their family members, she said, it's horrific. And when I said, will you meet with us to talk about an arms embargo? She said, yes, we'll meet with you and directed me towards some of her staff that we later on got to briefly exchange so we can have this open window or open door to figure out, you know, what are the next steps to actually having a official sit down meeting. And my response, you know, I know shortly after that, she went on stage. I was not at the rally. Abbas Alawi and I were not at the rally. And so we heard later her response to those protesters. And I wish her response was one that she led with compassion. I wish that she had addressed those protesters who are advocating for human rights differently. Because that is what these protesters are advocating. They are advocating that their loved ones, their family members, people that look like us, people that share a common language and culture, end this subjugation of violence against them. And they want to be heard.
Let me ask you your assessment of the Minnesota governor, Tim Walz, who is the vice presidential running mate of Kamala Harris. What he has to say about the uncommitted movement that you're co-chair of, Layla.
Yes, I know during the presidential primaries that Governor Walz went on, mainstream TV and said, you know, these are Democrats. These are voters who want to be listened to. Maybe we should listen to them. I do appreciate that is the point of view that he is coming from. And that is exactly what our movement and voters of Uncommitted want, is we want to be listened to. We demand to be listened to, because right now, the current Gaza policy is a immoral and unpopular policy.
Finally, could you see yourself voting for Harris and Walz? What would it take?
Right now, we need a policy change that will save lives. Until that happens, I don't see Michigan voters coming to support Vice President Kamala Harris and Tim Walz in the general election. We are demanding that this collective punishment of Palestinians end. We need a policy change that will protect our family members, our loved ones, and our people in Gaza right now. We want this unconditional, unchecked flow of weapons funding with our American taxpayer dollars, going to a far right wing government.
Layla El Abed, I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement, and also sister of Congressmember Rashida Tlaib. Next up, press freedom groups express alarm over felony hate crime charges brought against an accredited photojournalist in New York. Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Press freedom groups are raising alarm after New York police arrested a local journalist named Samuel Seligson and has charged him with 8 counts of criminal mischief with a hate crime enhancement, which is a felony. Police also raided Seligson's home twice over the past week. They're accusing him of traveling with pro-Palestinian activists who hurled red paint at the homes of top officials of the Brooklyn Museum in June. The Associated Press reports the complaint describes Seligson as a participant in the crime, but a law enforcement official told the AP he was not directly involved in the spray painting or property damage. He is a video journalist who's contributed footage to many news outlets. The Committee to Protect Journalists has criticized Seligson's arrest. Catherine Jacobson of CPJ said, "It's really important for authorities and the broader public to understand and differentiate the difference between protesters and journalists," quote. The Freedom of the Press Foundation warned Seligson's arrest is an attempt to criminalize journalism. On Thursday, I spoke to Samuel Seligson's lawyer, Lena Whiddy, and began by asking her to describe what actually happened.
My client, Samuel Seligson, is a 32-year-old independent videographer. He is being charged with 8 counts of criminal mischief, as you said, with a hate crime enhancement. At this stage, it's not clear that the state has not provided any evidence that he was involved in in property damage and that he was involved in any way beyond merely being present. If that is in fact the case, that is obviously consistent with his role as a journalist in documenting protest activities. And in fact, as you said, the NYPD has made statements to the press that they do not, that they are not alleging him to have been involved in the property damage. So it's extremely concerning, shocking to me and to my client that he's being charged with not only felony criminal mischief, but a hate crime enhancement. And
what does that mean, a hate crime enhancement?
A hate crime enhancement essentially means that the category of the crime, of the underlying crime for which you're charged, is bumped up.
So, from misdemeanor to felony?
Well, in this case, the criminal mischief in the third degree is an E felony, so it's bumped up to a D felony, which makes it one bail eligible and increases the potential sentence for a person if they're convicted. And is, of course, you know, I think significant in the way the public views conduct, significant in the way that, that the court system deals with conduct, and is absolutely dangerous in terms of the precedent that it sets for any pro-Palestine protesters and journalists covering that protest. It necessarily perpetuates the narrative that any protest against the support for genocide is necessarily synonymous with protest against Jewishness. And my client himself is Jewish, as are many other anti-Zionist protesters.
His home was raided twice?
Yes.
What does that mean?
That means the police went into his home on two separate occasions, attempted to arrest him, and on both occasions handcuffed his roommates and searched for him. And on the second occasion, we had already arranged a surrender with the NYPD, and he had planned, I had been in touch with the detective on the case, and he had planned to turn himself in, and yet a second raid was executed on his home.
So he is, you're arguing two things here. One is, does the police have evidence that he was even at the homes of the Brooklyn Museum officials documenting what the activists were doing?
So, yes, in order for the state to prove this case against him, they would have to prove two things. One, that he was in fact there, they would have to prove his identity. And two, that if he were there, he participated in the criminal mischief beyond mere presence, because merely being present, whether you're a journalist or not, is not enough to sustain criminal charges against you. So that he was there, that he participated beyond mere presence, and that he participated with the intent to damage property, and because of the hate crime enhancement, that he participated and was motivated, at least in part, by the identity of the people who own the homes. So by the race, national origin, sexual orientation of those people, which, and those are the protected classes that hate crimes legislation purportedly protects. Now, we know that hate crimes legislation, like other laws, is used in reality to actually prosecute the most vulnerable and not to protect the most vulnerable. My client is an independent journalist. He's Jewish himself. He's being accused, along with the other five individuals, is being accused of a hate crime for, even if true, protesting the homes of executives of multi-million dollar corporations who leverage extensive financial, cultural, political power and use that power in support of the genocide. And that is clearly what the protest is about. And it's absurd that it is being portrayed as crimes against the, as hate crimes because of some tangential relationship that these people may have to a protected class that my client is in fact part of. He is part of that protected class. He is Jewish.
Now, Samuel Seligson was previously arrested in May, is that right?
That's
live streaming a pro-Palestinian demonstration.
That's correct. With his press credentials, live streaming, thrown to the ground by police as people yelled, "He's press, he's press, he's press." And that case was not ultimately prosecuted by the district attorney's office.
Right. A spokesperson for the Brooklyn DA said the case had been closed and sealed.
I'm not representing him on that case, but my understanding is that it hasn't been prosecuted, that when he appeared for court, the district attorney's office was not prepared and you know, gave him a letter saying that he would be informed if they decided to prosecute the case.
Do you believe that the mayor is in any way involved in having him arrested? Of course, Mayor Adams is a former police officer himself.
You know, I can't speculate on what his specific role is, but we do know that Mayor Adams has been a huge proponent of ramping up police at pro-Palestine protesters, at pro-Palestine protests, excuse me. He has signed off on millions of dollars in overtime for the NYPD, who we have seen use increasing violence against Palestine protesters. You know, we're now 10 months into the genocide, and the violence at these protests continues. Meanwhile, Mayor Eric Adams is a huge proponent for cutting public services like the New York Public Library and 3K. And, you know, that hate crimes legislation is supposed to protect the most vulnerable people. It's supposed to prevent race-based violence. And actually, where we're seeing so much of that race-based violence in New York City is at these protests committed by the NYPD against Black and brown people, against Palestinians, and against anti-Zionist Jews. And you know, the city's resources would be much better spent addressing that.
So you're Palestinian American. You're a Palestinian American lawyer representing a Jewish journalist. If you can talk about how this fits into what you see as a broader crackdown on the pro-Palestinian protests, and particularly start by addressing groups like the Committee to Protect Journalists and the press freedom groups that are standing up for Samuel.
Yes. So it's wonderful to see all of these press groups standing up for Samuel, speaking out against the assault on journalists. And this is an assault on journalists that is happening worldwide. We are now 306 days into the genocide, and over 100 journalists, as you know well, have been massacred, and many more detained by Israel. This is an attempt to, it is an extremely concerning assault on the First Amendment. The reason why the freedom of press is so strongly protected is because there's some underlying belief that in order for the public to meaningfully participate in a democracy, they must be actually informed. And criminalizing the press, manufacturing risk that they will be prosecuted if they cover protests, is extremely chilling behavior. And everyone should be speaking up about it. Everyone should be concerned. Everyone should be identifying this as a political decision and not a legal one. It is political to charge a journalist with a crime while he is, you know, again, if he is proven to be there and if there is no evidence that he engaged in any of the underlying property damage, that he was just doing his job. It's extremely concerning that he's being charged, and even more concerning that he's being charged with a hate crime. And it's concerning that all of these people are being prosecuted for hate crimes, because it is an absolute misuse of the hate crimes legislation, and again, an exploitation of the law, which is not new, unfortunately, in this country, as we all know very well, an exploitation of the law to prosecute the most vulnerable in favor of the most powerful. And in this case, it's very stark.
Lena Widdy is attorney for Samuel Seligson, a New York City-based journalist charged with felony hate crime for allegedly filming pro-Palestinian activists hurling red paint at the homes of top officials at the Brooklyn Museum. Seligson's work has appeared in Reuters, Al Jazeera, ABC, and Fox News. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for director of development, support our fundraising efforts, and an archives intern to support our archives team. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.